Welcome to Shares from the American College of Financial Services, where money meets minds. Here's a look at what we'll be sharing with you today.
The more anxiety that someone felt, the higher the probability is that they would sell. We can help people make the right decisions even when it's a bad day in the market.
I'm Eric Ludwig, Director of the College's Retirement Income Certified Professional Program, and your host for this conversation on retirement income and planning. We're joined today by Chad Bennett, Director of the College's Chartered Financial Consultant and CFP Certification Education Programs. Chad, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thanks, Eric. Glad to be here.
Well, this is cool. So today we're really excited. The college has collected data on something called the Retirement Income Literacy Survey, and we're going to talk most about that. And I always feel like you can't sort of distinguish the research from the researcher. And so before we get into the research, what I wanted to do is ask a couple of questions about your personal background. So Chad, if you wouldn't mind, how did you actually get into the financial planning world? I know that we've talked a ton and known each other for several years, but I don't know if I actually know your background story on that.
Yeah, well, sometimes I ask myself that very question, to be honest. Going from the military and the Marine Corps and deploying overseas to then becoming a financial advisor is not a typical glide path that one takes. But I just found that after coming back from Iraq and I had some injuries, and in my recovery process, found myself struggling in some instances financially. And I had already begun working at a financial services company in a customer service role and was really perplexed by why did no one ever talk to me about some of these other things that I probably should have been thinking about. And so it kind of aggravated me, to be honest. And so I just decided that I wasn't going to be afraid to ask my family and friends some of those tough questions in hopes that it may prevent them from having a similar situation if that bad day occurs where there's an injury or illness or death. So that's kind of what launched me into it, is maybe a personal vendetta and wanting to make sure that others had the resources that were available.
That's really important. Yeah. Let's see. So you're Marine Corps, then you go into starting in the financial planning world, but somehow we got into this nerdy academic world. How did that take place? Because obviously you're interested in financial planning, but then you make the jump to master's degree, PhD. How did that all take place, and what were some of the reasons behind that?
You know, as I look back at it, and as I hear my parents talking about how I was as a person growing up and everything, I guess I'm not surprised that it came to this. I'm a little bummed it took so long, because it is a lot of fun. But I was always the kid that was asking why, and like, well, what if I did this? And what if I did this? And what would the result be here? And so being a financial planner, being an advisor where you are working with people, and people are the ultimate unknown variable, because we can account for a lot of things in the markets and try and explain them away. But when it comes to personal finance and financial planning, the variability of human nature and behavior is so vast that it never becomes boring. And the ability or lack thereof to answer the question, well, why is someone selling at the exact wrong time? It just, as an advisor, made me start asking a lot of questions that I wanted answers to, more specifically in the space of, as it pertained to, you know, veterans and service members, of how would PTSD counseling be impacted if we included elements of financial counseling, elements of financial planning, or just general financial empowerment techniques. And when there really wasn't anyone asking those questions, I just decided, well, maybe that person should be me. And so began work, I had GI Bill left, and began work on my master's and ultimately PhD.
And the PhD, for those that don't know, that's actually how Chet and I met each other, was we both, oddly enough, happened to enroll at Kansas State's program at the same time. And we've had so many conversations together. It's cool to finally get one recorded that that other people can listen to, too.
Right. I think we'd probably have like 100 podcast episodes if we just hit record on half the conversations that we have. Whether or not anyone would think they were interesting is another issue. But
right. That's true. Well, that makes me wonder. I mean, I know that we've had a lot of personal conversations as well, but when you think about like the progression that you've had. It's usually not a linear process, and there's usually some sort of temporary setback, at least along the way. Is there one of those that sticks out to you that was like, it seemed like something horrible sort of at the time, something bad that seemed like a failure, but that because of that failure or setback, it ended up setting you up for some sort of future success?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not one of those that, you know, I don't think anyone would ever say of me that anything he touches turns to gold, but I've failed forward often. And one such instance I can definitively remember as you're asking that is my original track in the Marine Corps was law school. And so when I first got into the Marine Corps and started progressing through, it was to become an officer and become JAG. And that was the plan. A really good friend of mine was on the same path, who actually retires next week as a JAG Marine. But in that path, when we went to training for that first summer, I injured my back and it got me kicked out of that program for that cycle. And that was in the summer of 2001. And so getting kicked out of that cycle, obviously September of 2001 occurs, and it really put me on a completely different arc within my military career of not wanting to be a desk person as an attorney, but go do the things that Marines do, which then, as I mentioned before, kind of progressed me into this profession. Had I stayed at JAG and all of those things occurred, again, it felt like a failure at the time. Maybe my buddy and I would be retiring together next week, and who knows? In the multiverse that is the decisions that we make and things that happen to us in life, yeah, you never know, but that one definitely sticks out.
I have a question we've been asking people on here. We often think about like these finite resources that we have, and obviously money being one of them, but I'm curious for you, is there a best or worst investment that you've had? And it doesn't have to be financial. It could be something like your energy, your time. Is there something that sticks out to you?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think intuitively, especially in our profession, we immediately hear the word investment and we do go to, oh, well, I bought this one stock, or gosh, I got into crypto too late, or whatever the heck it may be. But I think for me, looking back, and maybe it's just the stage of life that I'm in with kids that are now adults and everything too, and I look back and I the younger version of myself would never have considered it an investment, but I think like the education trajectory is such a huge investment. I'm not talking necessarily a traditional four-year institution. For me, the best education I got, to be frank, was being a young 18-year-old not knowing what he was doing with his life that ended up joining the military. And that gave me kind of a focused passion and a focused framework by which it still guides a lot of areas of my life, where I really think going to high school reunions and everything, most people are shocked to see that I'm alive and or not in jail or something. So I think that for me, and my wife would probably agree, was one of the best investments. As hectic and chaotic as it was and brought its own source of problems and everything and issues, definitely was a good investment of time and effort.
I love that. Yeah, it does seem like out of all the resources that we have, it's usually not the financial one that ends up making the list. What I wanted to do is transition to some of the research that we've actually done recently. And for those that don't know, the center that I direct, the Center for Retirement Income, has sponsored a survey called the Retirement Income Literacy Survey. And this is its fourth iteration. So I think the first one came out in 2014. And they've done a wave every 3 years. So this 2017, 2020, and then 2023 was the most recent one. The purpose of the study is to really, initially, was to just to get a snapshot of how are Americans doing on their knowledge in these different retirement planning areas. And just as a kind of an overview, the average score, so if you think, you know, 100% being somebody you got all of the questions correct, so there's 37 questions, the average score for the most recent one was 31%. So 31% is the average score. What's kind of interesting is before we ask the actual quiz questions, there's a self-assessed question that we ask, which is just like, how much retirement planning knowledge do you think that you have? And it's kind of a, I think it's a 1 to 5 scale. And what's interesting is if you use just that score alone, it ends up predicting quite a bit of other elements. So like for one, the people that had the lowest like self-assessed score, the ones that thought, yeah, I actually don't know that much, they were sort of right. Those people only got an 18% on the actual quiz versus those that thought, yeah, I actually have I do have a pretty good high amount of knowledge. They scored a 40%. So not great, but at least it was kind of in line with what their other scores were. The other thing I just was going to point out too is that even if you look at the amount of retirement assets that those two groups had, the people that thought that they didn't have that much knowledge, 73% of them had less than $100,000 saved for retirement. And these are people that, Chad, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think our sample...
It was 50. Yeah, 50 years old.
Yeah, so these people are getting close to retiring, and a big chunk of these had less than 100,000, as opposed to those that had like thought that they knew a fair amount about retirement planning knowledge. 81% of those people had more than 100,000. And there was also an interesting thing. So we kind of dial it back to like, okay, are people doing anything about that? Like in terms of, let's say I don't think that I have much knowledge, am I then using an advisor to sort of bridge that gap? And what was interesting is that for those that self-assessed that they had low retirement planning knowledge, only 8% of them, 8% are using an advisor versus those that thought that they actually knew a fair amount, 56% of them are using a financial advisor. So some pretty big important gaps there. And I wanted to ask you, Chad, I mean, based on your experience as a financial planner and someone that's done a lot of research in this biopsychosocial area, which we probably need to define what that is first. What are some of the findings that stuck out to you from the survey?
Yeah, so I guess let's touch on biopsychosocial first. And that's something I think it sounds real fancy, but most of us as consumers of medical services have been exposed to it for a while because it came out in the 70s, late 70s, where medical practitioners really started saying, look, we need to treat the whole person. And when someone comes in for knee pain, there are the biological variations of the knee pain, of course, but then there's psychological, their perception of pain. Do they have past traumas? Because people feel pain differently. Sociologically, what resources do they have to help them overcome the pain, or resources in the home and family resources and relationships? So when medical researchers began looking at this, they said, hey, you know what? Part of our interventions that would increase the efficacy and the results of things like physical therapy for a sore knee or after a knee surgery might be looking at some of these other components of the psychological and sociological elements. So that never really has been pulled into personal finance until really recently. And no one, I mean, the research I'm doing is looking at the totality of the biopsychosocial inside of personal finance. But in our retirement income literacy survey, we do have some really interesting variables that are common when measuring some of the psychosocial elements. And specifically, the variables that we used in this survey come from FINRA Foundation. So FINRA Foundation sponsors what we call the NFCS. It's the National Financial Capability Study. And inside of that study, there's a series of questions that are asked that ultimately ask the participant and the respondent things like, when it comes to thinking about your financial matters, how anxious do you feel? And another one may be, when it comes to thinking about your finances, I feel a level of stress or physically feel my heart beating faster. So in most of the research in using those questions, or questions like it, we can really operationalize those to say that's a good indicator of financial anxiety for the one question and financial stress for the other question. So some of the things I was interested when we looked at this, certainly the scores are a telling thing, but what other factors might be playing in here? So looking at it from a financial anxiety standpoint, when we look at the financial anxiety level of all of the respondents in our sample, we had a score of 4.29 is what it was. And that's out of a scale of 7. So a little bit more than midway. Okay. And that's great. But like you said, we had also the ability to measure, do these people have financial advisors or not? And those without a financial advisor, even when we look at all the different factors of whether they're male, female, net worth, all of the other issues, age, all of those things, the people without a financial advisor had a higher score in financial anxiety of 4.6. Those with a financial advisor had a 3.8. So we automatically in the anxiety section, we're seeing that just the presence of that financial advisor in that person's situation had a 20% improvement in the level of financial anxiety that they faced. The financial stress was actually a little bit more telling even still, because the baseline levels of that in the financial stress was 3.8, again, out of that 7-point scale. People without a financial advisor were 4.1 on average, and then people with an advisor were 3.3. So in that one, we saw 25% improvement in the levels of financial stress and when it came to just the presence of an advisor. So I think that, you know, some of what this is telling us, which in this profession, we're probably not overly surprised as we get invited to birthdays and retirement parties and graduations and everything else, that when we have a relationship with our clients and with the consumers that we serve in society, our presence, our knowledge, the way we convey it, those are important elements. And we know that beyond just, hey, I can put an asset allocation portfolio, you know, a good portfolio together for you, or create the best glide path into retirement. Now we're seeing actual results that we're having a direct impact on people's psychological health, their view of anxiety and their view of stress. And that's an important thing that we need to make sure in this profession that we're really communicating both to society and policy and rulemakers and lawmakers and everything, but also just that comfort of when we're working with our clients.
The American College of Financial Services, championing causes, connecting communities, delivering best-in-class applied financial knowledge and education
for the benefit of professionals like you and for the benefit of society.
Expand your opportunities at the all-new theamericancollege.edu.
We were talking about this, I know recently you and I were, about the industry is trying to still kind of come up with a number, if you will, on like, what is the value of a financial advisor? And I think that's a good approach, but you're not going to be able to capture some of the things that you mentioned. Like, you can't capture in a number lowered stress, lower financial anxiety.
I'm going to stop you and I'm going to say yet, because we're working on that. Because, I mean, we do know that in other research, lower amounts of stress can be a better predictor of results of lower heart disease. There's a lot of evidence in the medical research that shows that when we lower stress, when we lower some of these things, the cortisol levels go down. Like, there's a whole body of research associated with that. So I agree, it's not something in our profession and in the research that's been done in the past that has been looked at when we're trying to evaluate the value of an advisor to a singular client. But honestly, I think the value of professional financial advice or professional financial counseling, it can be monetized in this biopsychosocial framework, because we know that as we lower these levels, it actually saves money from an insurance health insurance standpoint and medical issues and all of the other things. So I agree with the asterisk of yet.
Right. I like that. Yeah, that there is a way to quantify it.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Chad, I know one of the other things that we studied in this survey was concerns that people have in retirement. And going off of memory, I think there was 9 or 10 different areas. Can you maybe explain what those different areas were and then some of the interesting findings?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It was 10. There was 10 subsets to this topic of concerns during retirement. And so the question was asked, of the following things, how concerned are you about ... and then an item. The scoring on that was 1 being no problem, no worries, I'm not worried about it at all. 7 being, oh my gosh, the house is on fire. So some of those topics were things like running out of money, the cost of healthcare, changes in tax rates, impact of inflation, cuts to Social Security, market volatility, so on and so forth. And some of the ones that had the highest scores in the entire sample were things like impact of inflation and cuts to Social Security. You and I have talked about this with some of these. It's really, would that be different if it was asked at a different time? And so we are looking back at previous responses on this from our previous waves of the retirement income literacy survey. But in this survey sample asked in 2023, when inflation was at in the headlines all the time, and if it wasn't in the headlines, it was certainly in your pocketbook, regardless of whether you were retirement age or not, that was one of the highest ones. And so it had a 5.4 out of the 7. And the next highest, or a little bit higher than that even, was the Social Security, cuts to Social Security. So on average for the whole sample, we took all 10 of those questions, added up the scores to get an average score of this domain of concerns during retirement. And our entire sample had a score of 4.6. You know, again, we wanted to look, because of the role the college plays in educating advisors, is, hey, advisors, how are we helping with that? How are we helping with concerns, hearing it from the mouths of the consumers when it comes to these topics? And I'll say that without an advisor, that average goes from 4.6 to 4.7. So not a huge jump if they don't have an advisor as compared to the whole sample. But when they do have an advisor, it goes to 4.3. And some of the areas, there's pretty dramatic changes in it that the consumer clearly feels, with an advisor or without an advisor, that their advisor is going to help. They're not concerned about it because their advisor is helping take care of that. Running out of money was a big difference in favor of having an advisor. Another issue was that had a big difference was paying off debts. So people that had an advisor, that wasn't a huge concern, 2.9. People with that had an advisor. People without an advisor is 4. So there was big variation inside of there that I think is important, that when we're looking at what role we play in consumers' behavior and perception and everything else, is that we do matter as a profession and as an industry when it comes to some of these things that are affecting physiological or psychological health, and concerns and anxiety and stress are certainly among those.
So if I heard you right, the two would like kind of the biggest deltas was the running out of money concern and then the paying off debts, right? Is that right?
Yep.
That's kind of interesting because both of those end up being sort of a cash flow management thing. When it comes to running out of money, do you have a thought on like why you think the advisor is playing such an important role there?
If we're talking about this really, really empirically from a research standpoint, there could be conflating factors, right? There could be issues that are identified that, well, they're not worried about running out of money because the type of person that has a financial advisor doesn't worry about running out of money anyway because they have good cash flows or good net worth. So it could be that that's part of the explanation. Likewise, paying off debts, that by far had the biggest delta. The difference on that was 1.01. But again, it could be that the advisor is just amazing at helping people understand their cash flow and not have debt. It could be that that's the case. It also could be the case, though, that the type of person that has an advisor doesn't worry about those things anyway, and that's how they're able to have a financial advisor. I think from a research standpoint, it's wise to look at it from that lens, because we can't empirically and emphatically say that, gosh, if you have an advisor, you're not going to run out of money. If you have an advisor, you won't have any debt because you've paid it all off. We can't say that from an academic standpoint because of those conflating factors. But from a profession standpoint, it does go to, like, it points out that a role of the advisor does matter, and that if we can help people get to the point where they can say, yes, I have a financial advisor, in whatever form that may take, will that help with some of those things and be directionally pointing to that?
You know, it does make me think, too, like some of the other ones that had really small deltas were things that are kind of out of the advisor's control, right? Like the changes in tax rates, it was a really small difference. And it's like, okay, well, the client in this case, or the respondent to our survey in this case, didn't really matter. I mean, they probably understand like, okay, well, that's outside of my advisor's control anyways, so that there's really no difference. And same thing with the impact of inflation. It's like, well, it's sort of a global issue So regardless, so it does kind of make me still think that there is something going on. I agree with what you said for sure. There's a lot of other confounding variables, but it does make me think when you look at the whole list and it's like, well, the things that the advisor can have an impact on, that really did make a big difference in their overall concern there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Chet, we know that this survey was originally meant to get a feel for how just individuals in the States did on retirement income planning areas. But I think what we've been talking about a lot today is actually the role that the advisor plays in a lot of these different areas. I'm wondering, as you think about what we talked about today and some of the other stuff that we studied, how do you think financial advisors could use this information in their practice?
Well, an example going back to anxiety and stress, for instance, and obviously advisors played a vital role in these responses anyway, in our survey, of lowering the amount of instance that people said they were stressed or anxious about their finances. So when we dig into that deeper, another implication and something that advisors can take from that is that when they're involved in consumers' finances, and specifically when it comes to choice of investments, another question we asked was, in times of market volatility, how likely would it be that you would sell stocks at a loss? Some variant of that question. In other words, are you going to sell at the wrong time? Are you going to sell when things are bad? And yes, we obviously saw that with an advisor, those were lower than without an advisor. But more importantly, in my area of looking at this from the psychosocial element, is that the more anxiety that someone felt or had, were financially anxious, the higher the probability is that they would sell, with or without, you know, with or without an advisor. Obviously, again, the advisor moderates that. Same thing with financial stress. The more, and this was across the board, that the more financially stressed they were, the more likely they were going to sell at the wrong time. So I think, again, from a profession standpoint, as financial planners, financial advisors, that is an area that we really need to be able to look to, and is an implication of practice to say, hey, we should be having these talks because we can help people make not the wrong decision, and we can help them actually make the right decisions even when it's a bad day in the market.
Yeah, that seems so important. You know, Chet, I know that you and I have spent the last year or more talking about artificial intelligence, and you know, it seems like 10 years ago the rage was robo-advisors, and then it took quite a while for this kind of conversational ChatGPT and things like that to come out. And I know you and I have had a lot of conversations about like thinking about, okay, well, now if people have greater access to this information, what role is that going to play? And what role is the financial advisor going to play? And so I think we kind of ran out of time for today. But if it's all right with you, I'd like to, hopefully we can do another follow-up episode where we talk more about that.
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, I think you mentioned it at the beginning that of the, I think we've referred to them as DNA respondents, right? Like, so our human respondents to this quiz got a 31%. So I guess the spoiler slash dangling carrot for next time is think about, if you're listening right now, think about what you think the ChatGPT would have done, this all-knowing entity, on this quiz. The spoiler alert is, advisors, you still matter.
Well, thank you so much, Chet. I know people are going to love this. And thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
Thanks. Great talking to you, Eric.
That's all for now. But you can find all our episodes on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other streaming services. Be sure to like us, follow us, and leave us a rating and review. Shares is a production of the American College of Financial Services. And we hope you join us next time as we share ideas that expand your opportunities.